At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
A t-shirt and jeans, mac and cheese, oceans and sunsets. Some things in life are an obvious match, like RIAs and Schwab Advisor Services, the number one choice for independent advisors looking for a custodian who can help them go further. With all the wealth services, technology, and support an RIA firm needs, the difference is so obvious, it's Schwabious. Find your match and learn why custody is just the beginning at Schwabious.com.
Giles Brown. GB.
Not GQ. I'm going to be speaking, all things being equal, with Mark Blake about his new book called Dreams, The Many Lives of Fleetwood Mac.
Freedom. Well, who am I to keep you down?
unmistakable sound of Fleetwood Mac and Dreams. And Dreams is the name of the new book by Mark Blake, The Many Lives of Fleetwood Mac, from the early days through the 70s, the 80s. There has never been a band with so much musical brilliance, infighting, sexual tension, you name it, they've had it. Delighted to say that joining us once more from somewhere looks rather nice in the UK, is author of Dreams, Mark Blake. Mark, once again, good to have you with us.
Good afternoon. Lovely to be here again.
And so, we come to Fleetwood Mac. Everybody here will remember Rumours. It was the album that defined the 70s. It was the album that was full of brilliant songs, but so much was going on backstage. It was just a complete fracas. You can't look at the 70s without looking at Fleetwood Mac, can you?
No, you can't, no. I mean, that album came out beginning of 1977, but yeah, one of the biggest selling albums in the world, still sells today on physical vinyl and CDs, which is extraordinary considering the streaming world we live in.
And it also effortlessly had that sort of American sound and that UK sound, which not a lot of people were doing. You know, Rod Stewart was doing Atlantic Crossing, McCartney was doing his bits and pieces with Wings, but when it goes back to it, I mean, Fleetwood Mac was Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac in the 60s, and it was firmly rooted in the UK blues explosion.
Yeah, it was a very male British blues band. It was very blokey, typical kind of post-war London blues band. And then it sort of mutates into this Anglo-American thing later on, obviously for Rumours. But yeah, Peter Green was a fabulously gifted guitarist. He formed the band, got John McVie and Mick Fleetwood in, and named the band after them, which is very convenient because Peter Green only stuck around for a couple of years. So they were able to keep the name and carry on.
But I mean, were they seen as sort of blues purists in the sort of way that, I don't know, John Mayall and the Blues Breakers were doing? Was that their sort of gig?
Right. Yeah. They were at the beginning, yes, very much so. But Peter Green himself wanted to change that. I mean, even after the first couple of singles, he was experimenting and moving on. But obviously, the big hit from the Peter Green era is Albatross, the instrumental, which everyone knows, which isn't blues at all. And they made lots of people very cross who used to go and see them as a blues band. Like, what are you doing now? You sold out, man, etc. And of course, that's the beginning of the next stage. They kept changing, even with Peter Green. They were never going to stay as a blues band.
So was it a sort of a meeting of equals then with John McVie and Mick Fleetwood? Because
not really. I think the thing is, Peter Green was seen as a star. You know, he was going to be the next Eric Clapton. He kept replacing Eric Clapton in various bands, but a very different temperament, very quiet guy, quite a shy guy. Mick Fleetwood had been fired from the band he'd been in before for not playing drums properly. He'd been fired from John Mayall's Blues Breakers. But Peter Green got on with it. And Mick Fleetwood was going to become a window cleaner.
Right.
Bought a set of window cleaners ladders, but couldn't get a gig cleaning windows. And then Peter Green rang him up and said, I'm starting a new band and I want you and John McVie in it. And that's basically what happened.
So when it all sort of, because they have Man of the World, which is, you know, a great song, a beautiful guitar solo on it. I mean, the thing with Green is he did play, he was like B.B. King. He played notes, with two notes he would do, but then he could mix it up like with Oh Yeah, which again is another wonderful track.
Oh, well, it's almost like a heavy metal song. It's almost like the beginning of heavy metal. I think the thing with Peter Green is it's almost what he didn't play as much as what he did play. I mean, at that time, you had people like Clapton and Alvin Lee. The emphasis was on, can you play 100 notes a minute sort of thing? And he was a complete antithesis of that. He wasn't glamorous looking. He didn't dress himself up to look like Jimi Hendrix, which, of course, was what a lot of guitarists did at that time. So he just took his own, he followed his own path. He really did. He was quite unique.
So he followed his own path, and his own path takes him away into some interesting areas, you know, and he basically, the band sort of cools down. That could have been it. I mean, Fleetwood could have gone back to getting a window gig, and of course, this is the time when every band during the early 70s is swapping members. You've only got to look at people like, you know, Deep Purple, Jethro Tull, Uriah Heep. I mean, the family trees make the Plantagenets look like a normal sort of two up, two down, don't they?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know, John McVie didn't even want to join to begin with because he had a good gig with John Mayall's Blues Breakers. But, you know, it could have changed. But Peter Green, just as soon as it became successful, Peter Green walked away from it, which I think caused untold you know, pain and heartache within the group. I'm not sure John McVie's ever quite forgave him for that, to be honest.
So where do they go from there? And is Lindsay Buckingham in at this? Lindsay's not in at this point, but, you know, is the, you know, when does, for example, Christine McVie come in? I mean, that's...
Well, Christine McVie came in because she married John McVie.
Yeah.
And she'd previously been singing and performing in her own group and doing some solo stuff. And she decided she got stage fright, of all things. Didn't want to do it anymore. Missed John when he was on tour. So she stayed at home. They all lived communally in a house in Hampshire.
Right.
And she used to cook stews and wash clothes and be like the den mother. And then when it was time for them to go on tour, and this was after Peter Green had left, and they decided they needed a piano player. So they asked her to come along. And of course, she then subsequently stuck with the band and proceeded to write some of the biggest hits of their career much, much later on in the 70s.
So who's doing the vocals and who's doing the lead guitar at this point then?
At that point in time, they had Jeremy Spencer and Danny Kirwan, who were these other guitar players that Peter Green had brought in. It's weird. Peter Green was a guitar hero, but he kept surrounding himself with other guitarists. He didn't want the responsibility and he left.
Right.
Kirwan and Spencer were quite strange, volatile characters. They eventually left and he got an American in called Bob Welch. So there's this weird period after Peter Green and before Rumours where they were making records and maintaining touring America with a guy called Bob Welch. And there's some interesting stuff on those records, but they weren't having the big hit and the big breakthrough.
So it's
then they found Lindsay Buckingham.
So,
and Steve.
So it's earlier, I think it's, isn't it 73, 74, they rock up to Sound City, which is this down at heel but legendary recording studio on the outskirts of LA, if I'm not much mistaken.
That's right, yeah. It's up near the Budweiser factory. It's on the inside of one of the Neil Young albums. There's a photograph of Neil Young stretched out on the couch at Sound City. And what happened, Mick Fleetwood was looking for a studio he could record the next Fleetwood Mac album in. He met a producer called Keith Olsen. Keith showed him round. I interviewed Keith. He's not with us anymore, but I interviewed him a few years ago. And while he was there, Lindsay Buckingham and Stevie Nicks happened to be doing some recording in the studio next door. They had a duo.
With the imaginative title called Buckingham Nicks, surprisingly enough.
Called Buckingham Nicks.
Wow,
in fact,
that must have taken ages.
Failed to sell many records and weren't really doing very well. And Olsen played Mick Fleetwood a couple of tracks just to demonstrate the sound of the studio. And he was very impressed by what he heard. And when he left the studio, he then discovers he gets a phone call from Bob Welch saying, "I'm leaving." It's like, oh my God, what do we do? So he phoned up Keith Olsen and said, who was the boy? Who was the guy and who was the girl that were in the studio? Who was that duo you played me tracks by? Now, the fact is he really wanted Lindsay Buckingham, the guitarist. And as Stevie Nicks has never let Mick Fleetwood forget the fact that she had to come as part of the package. So she's browbeaten him with this, I think, for like nearly 50 years. But that is the truth. You know, he originally wanted a guitar player, but he wouldn't come without her. And so, of course, she joins the existing band and the rest is history. But it's serendipity. Yeah. It's a pure...
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you think, I mean, if he'd just go on his own, Fleetwood Mac wouldn't have become... Because Nicks,
no.
When she's unleashed on an unsuspecting public, and also the bond that she forms with Christine McVie and brings her out of her shell as well. I mean,
yes, very much so.
Nobody... Yeah. I mean, there's the album, isn't it? There was the unnamed album where he's got the one with Landslide. I mean, is that the first one she's on? Or is the
yeah,
first
it's called
one?
Fleetwood Mac. It's called the White Album, isn't it? It's the one with the white cover. I mean, that was a massive hit. That's the first thing they did together with the new lineup. And that was a huge hit. And then a year or so later, you get Rumours. But of course, you know, what complicates it is that Lindsay Buckingham and Stevie Nicks were also a couple and they're in the process of breaking up. They were even around the time they joined Fleetwood Mac, but they stayed together for the sake of being in the band. So you've got this incredible emotional, romantic, sexual tension within the group, plus you've got Christine and John McVie splitting up at the same time. So it's a sort of a vortex of turmoil.
Yeah.
And while they're making these fabulous records.
And yeah, and also it's the mid-70s and it's, shall we call it, and they're in Los Angeles and it's hedonistic, to put it mildly.
Very hedonistic. Yeah. Lots of late nights, you know, a lot of late nights. They spent a fortune on champagne alone, you know, just in the studio. So you factor in all that as well. So it's a pretty heady combination. And I think it feeds into the music. The music benefited from it, even if obviously they didn't as human beings.
But it's one of those albums where there's not a weak track really on the whole thing. I mean, they must have sat. Did they? Do you think at the time they thought, hang on, because they're all bringing something to it, and Stevie's gone full witch mama on at this point, and will now adorn every schoolboy's imagination from time immemorial. But you know, the actual playing, I mean, it's tight as hell. There are no huge guitar solos. They're not trying to be punk. They're not trying to be AOR. They're not doing a sort of like American friendly, a unit shifting record. It really is a statement.
It's a statement record because I think as tuneful as it is and how many hits there are on it, there's an edge to a lot of it. And a lot of that's to do with Lindsey Buckingham. Mm. You know, he really pushed Fleetwood and McVie out of their comfort zone. I mean, terrible arguments in the studio. But if you listen to everything on it, it's layered. It's not your classic, just soft rock. And nothing wrong with that, but there's layers and layers and there's depth to what's in the music. And I think that's one of the reasons it survived. It doesn't sound out of date now. Well, unlike a lot of records from the 70s, it hasn't dated.
So were they prepared for the level of vump they got? You know, because it just went massive, didn't it?
Absolutely. I think it was almost too big. But no, they weren't prepared for it at all. I don't think anybody is really. And of course, it had a huge impact on their lives, their personal lives, but also on their musical lives. Because of course, the next thing you've got to do is when you've done an album like Rumours, which has gone on to sell 50 million or something last week, whatever it was.
Yeah.
What do you do after that? Where do you go next? I mean, it's a classic situation that faces a band when they have a really huge record.
But the other thing is they've got a tour. And the stories of Fleetwood Mac on tour at this point in their lives make, you know, Keith Moon look like a blushing choir boy. There are various false rumours about various substances being blown up various bits of people's bodies.
Yes,
that one. Yes, indeed. And small, but there was a market. There was a small tent or a small gazebo, wasn't there, where they could go off and perhaps get a bit more energised during the gigs.
There was a lot of energising going on during the gigs. Yeah, I mean, their tour manager, John Courage, who I met, he's no longer with us. One of John's jobs was sort of keeping those members that wished to indulge sort of fortified. John McVie once said to me, one of the problems with playing big arenas is if there were seats around and behind, they could see what they were getting up to when they went behind the amps. So that started to become a problem, I think, hence the tent you referred to. So there was a little bit more privacy. But yeah, it was a wild and very, very hedonistic time.
But yet they still managed to keep the live performances together.
Yes, they did. I mean, they made they became a fabulous live band. And I think part of that is they now had a front person. They had Stevie Nicks. Previously, you know, Christy McVie sang, but behind the keyboard. Lindsey Buckingham sang, but behind the guitar. So you had this weird yin and yang between him and Buckingham. But Stevie Nicks was the closest they had to a lead singer like a Mick Jagger or a Roger Daltrey or something.
And if you put it in its context of its time as well, this is 77, this is 70s. I mean, mainly you've got, you know, the big bands. You've got The Who. You've got the tail end of Zeppelin. You've got Stones still there. Anything, but they're all guys. So a woman appears as a backing singer, and yet here you have this huge band with two women, and really, I mean, Lindsey's playing. You know, Lindsey Buckingham is playing. I mean, he's got these amazing guitar solos, but they're playing sort of quiet foil to this force of nature.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this was a groundbreaking thing at the time to have a mixed band where the girl, like you said, the women were not just backing singers. I mean, there's great stories about Christy McVie and Stevie Nicks being on stage at sound checks when they first joined, and you know that a buildings manager or someone going, you know, get those broads off the stage. They just presumed they were someone's girlfriend. They heard that all the time. People didn't believe that they were actually in the band in those early days. So that side of it is groundbreaking, I think.
Yeah, and you mentioned, so Rumours is huge, and of course the thing everybody's expecting is Rumours 2, which would have been interesting. They could have been an AOR. They could have done the REO Speedwagon trick or whatever. But what they do, you know, because it's a time of FM as well. That's the thing. But what they do is Tusk. And Tusk, if you're expecting Rumours 2, it is as far removed from that as anyone can get. And all those people who were wanting their comfort zone and sit around and sing beautiful harmonies got the shock of their lives.
Yes. I mean, Tusk's a double album. There are songs on it that sound similar to the ones on Rumours, but this is very much Lindsey Buckingham's project. Because I should add, by this point, he's almost producing the records. He's become the musical director, and he wanted to go somewhere left field, which he really, really did. I mean, he was recording songs while he was doing push-ups to get this sort of urgency in his voice. He got Mick Fleetwood to play A Box of Tissues, A Leg of Lamb. In fact, on the song Tusk itself, Mick is playing a leg of lamb, hitting it with a stick,
right,
along with various drums. So there was all sorts of recording techniques and unusual ideas here. And of course, it didn't sell anywhere near the number of copies that Rumours did, but it's actually a fantastic record. And I think it kind of saved their career because it gave them an edge and gave them something else. Otherwise, they didn't just slip into that kind of mainstream FM radio thing that they could have easily done.
And also, but they're also doing side projects. I mean, Stevie Nicks is doing, 1981, she does Belladonna.
Belladonna.
Yeah.
Yeah, so she becomes a pop star in her own right, which causes all no end of kind of aggravation. And Lindsey Buckingham makes solo record that isn't as big a hit. So you've got all this trauma where they think they're going to lose her as their lead singer. That never happens. But, of course, she becomes a very big star in the early 80s when they're still trying to maintain.
So how does that sort of balance the group, and what's Mick doing, and what and the others? I mean, they're just sort of sitting back and letting them get on with it.
Well, there's an element of sitting back and letting them do things. I think Mick Fleetwood is the glue that holds the whole Fleetwood Mac together. He wanted to get them working, so he got them back in the studio. I think for 1982, they made an album called Mirage, which is much closer to Rumours. It's actually a really good record and quite underrated. But you know, there's nothing there that's going to scare the horses. But you know, by that point, they've got to accommodate Stevie Nicks as well. And so after Mirage, they were off the road for about 3 or 4 years.
But then they come back with Tango in the Night, don't they?
Absolutely massive album. They persuaded Lindsey Buckingham to do it again. I mean, he was making a solo record. In fact, half of his solo record ended up on Tango in the Night. It was a massive, massive record, but they couldn't sustain. And then Buckingham left the band and they enter this really weird and slightly depressing period for about 3 or 4 years where they're touring with other people and their stock starts to drop and drop and drop. You mentioned REO Speedwagon. They end up playing a fairground, you know, with REO Speedwagon on the bill and Pat Benatar. And it's literally like they're playing Magic Mountain somewhere in you know,
they've gone full tap.
The result, they have gone to that stage. Yeah. You know, they have hit that sort of Spinal Tap moment.
So what's the thing that, I mean, apart from Rumours still shifting huge amounts, what's the thing that keeps them, that's brought them back? Because, okay, I mean, they tried to get back and then sort of Buckingham, you know, exploded halfway through the tour. And now, of course, you know, we no longer have Christy McVie with us, which was a shock to the system because, I mean, her and Stevie were close, to put it mildly. Mm. So is it that, I mean, have they been rediscovered by the TikTok generation? Is it that?
Yeah, they have been, most definitely. Yeah, like it goes back to what I was saying, and it hasn't aged. That stuff is still heard in films and so on. I mean, the chain's been used in so many movies and TV shows. That's kept it going. And they got rediscovered. They could be rediscovered through streaming services, through country music stars, modern country music stars, covering their work. Stevie Nicks did a song with Lana Del Rey, that kind of thing. They were adopted by the next generation and the next generation after that. And they carried on touring, you know, up until the early 2000s, including with the classic lineup before it sort of finally splintered. And they could still perform live. They still had this amazing catalogue of hits to do, to perform. They sort of rode out the changes. They never seemed to become massively unfashionable the way Uriah Heep or Deep Purple or the bands you mentioned earlier did, where they start to become more niche. They still remained mainstream. I went to see them a few years ago at the O2 in London. There were plenty of people dressed up, women dressed up as Stevie Nicks, clattering up the escalator, you know, with platform boots on. And
well, my goddaughter, who is the oldest one, has got more ink than an enraged octopus. She's not got that many tattoos, and is a full on witch. You know, the whole thing. She went with her witch, you know, her friends who all look like Wednesday, the TV series or whatever.
Yes,
and she went to see Stevie Nicks, and it was an act of pilgrimage. It really was a Hyde Park.
She played Hyde Park here in the summer, and that's, I mean, she's almost bigger than Fleetwood Mac now. But I think that's kept the thing generated, keeps the music generated, because she's got that audience, then go back and listen to the stuff she was doing 40 years ago.
So when it comes to putting this together, I mean, where do you start? I mean, obviously from the, I mean, it's not just a, it's not just a, then they did this record, then they did that record.
No, it's not like that at all. No, that's the way I didn't want to do a book like that. So it starts at the beginning, but it's short stories. They're short chapters, short entries on songs, albums, events. Everything runs chronologically, but you can open it up anywhere, read a page and a half chapter or 3 or 4 page chapter, and you know it works on its own in isolation. So it's a biography that's been done that way. It's lots of small entries and small stories and anecdotes. It's full of anecdotes.
Yeah, which must be very interesting of that lot. I just thought to myself, which happens now and again, Fleetwood Mac didn't do any of the big charity,
They didn't do Live Aid. No, they weren't really together at the time. That's the main reason why. Peter Green did a mini Live Aid in a tiny pub in Camden.
Right. That's about right.
On the day of Live Aid. Right,
he did.
Tiny little pub in Camden.
He did Lock Aid.
Yeah. And meanwhile, in America, Judas Priest were playing his song, The Green Man Unleashed You with a Two-Pronged Crown.
Wow. Yeah. I mean,
that's the closest Fleetwood Mac got to.
But when you revisit the back catalogue, you go through the songs. I mean, it must be, it reinforces how important they have been and influential in a way that perhaps there's no other band really like them, is there?
No, there's not. And I think that's what's fascinating about it, makes them interesting to write about. They're unique. They're utterly unique. And it was, like I say, it's serendipity. It's a strange, happy accident. They go from being the most male band in the world to suddenly becoming really a band that I think in many people's mind is a female fronted group.
Yeah.
You know, the guys are almost secondary, which I think annoys the hell out of Lindsey Buckingham. And understandably, because he is the musical talent there and does an enormous amount for the band, but you know, no one buys his song.
Yeah, but you kind of get the idea that quite a lot of things maybe annoy Lindsey Buckingham, you know.
A lot annoys him. I do like the guy, and he's lightened up, I think, over the years. He's a brilliantly talented guy, and he had a huge part in all of their songs, Christine's and Stevie's as well. But like I say, it's Christine and Stevie that the public latch onto. The last time I interviewed Lindsey Buckingham, he said to me, he said he'd been kicked out of Fleetwood Mac again.
He said,
I'm aware that for a lot of that audience to turn up at a stadium to see Fleetwood Mac, as long as Stevie's there, they don't really care who else is there. They don't.
Lindsey Buckingham's got one of the best. I don't know if it's true, but there's an anecdote about a journalist in 1978 going over to Lindsey's, and he's got this like Japanese place in LA with, you know, koi carp, and he's there in a kimono at a Zen garden. He's wandering around the grounds, and he turns to the journalist and goes, "And all this, it might have been Mick. Well, all this is just one hit song away."
I'd never heard that. I wish I'd had that in there. But I can most definitely visualize him in a kimono.
Yeah.
Walking around a Japanese garden. I'll have to ask Mick about that story. It sounds like the kind of thing he'd come up with.
Exactly. Yeah. Listen, what do you hope that people are going to take then from the book?
I think it makes you want to go back and listen to the music, and including maybe some of the music that doesn't get heard as much. And I wanted to make people laugh. I think there's some, they were larger than life characters. And some of these stories are fantastic and hilarious and sad and tragic. And it's from an era that's gone.
Yes.
That's not me sounding like a crusty old duffer talking about the good old days. It's just that world has changed. Music has changed since then. There isn't the money to be indulged the way that they were. But out of all that indulgence, they made some fantastic music.
Yeah, and also, you know, Taylor Swift, bless her. I mean, she would never have been Taylor Swift without Stevie setting the... I mean, I doubt that Taylor Swift has a tent backstage, but, you know, Stevie set blazed the trail, as it were.
She's a godmother for so many of female performers now. Yeah.
The book is called Dreams, The Many Lives at Fleetwood Mac. Fantastic cover, by the way. If people want to follow you online, Mark, before we get you back for the next one, where can they find you?
Well, I'm online. I'm on Instagram. I'm on X. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just look for me there. Mark Blake 3 on X.
Indeed. Yeah. And you can order
on Twitter, as I still call it.
Exactly. Something about multimillionaires. And also you can order the book via our own bookstore. Only begs the question, Mark, what are you up to? As the sunlight streams through the blinds in a very Blade Runaway in your studio, what are you up to next?
I'm resting now. I'm all macked out. No, I'm doing some magazine pieces, working on a few ideas for something else. But I might go on holiday. Yeah.
Right. Take your tent. The book is called Dreams, The Many Lives of Fleetwood Mac. It's by Mark Blake. Mark, once again, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on today.
Thank you very much. Pleasure. Cheers.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.